Okay, good morning, everyone. I hope you're doing well. Today we're going to be talking about professional confidentiality, which is a very, very important topic, both legally and halachically. It is part of one's professional obligation to maintain confidential information, either from the patient or about the patient. And we're going to see that halacha has a very similar rule. In many ways, this is not such a difficult topic. People make it more difficult than it is because it happens to be that your secular obligations are more or less the same as your halachic obligations. And this is not going to be an extremely strong point of conflict, but sometimes it will be, and it's important to at least be aware of the differences. But I will tell you ahead of time that there are much more difficult conflict navigation than this particular area. Most of the time, when secular law says keep it confidential, halacha would say it as well. And most of the time when halacha says you have to violate a confidence, secular law will as well, but they are different systems, and it's important to be aware of this. And I'm sure that you've explored this with probably every single teacher that you've had, that one of the most important things that every professional has to realize is that we do have multiple roles in life. You know, you will be doctor, pharmacist, social worker, whatever it will be. You have a professional identity. Then you have an identity as a Jew. You have an identity as a husband or a wife, an identity as a parent, an identity as a human being. And in many, many ways, far too often in Western cultures, we define our identity almost exclusively by our professional affiliation. You know, what are you? For example, I am a doctor. I am a lawyer. That's not really what are you. That's what you would do for a living, and that's part of the contribution you make to humanity, hopefully, in a good way. But essentially, if you're woken up in the middle of the night, someone shakes you and says, who are you? What are you? The answer you're supposed to give is, I'm a Jew. I'm a servant of Hashem. And everything else is supposed to just be a derivative of that. As a result, as a general rule, and we're going to see how halacha navigates this, it is axiomatic that when there is a conflict between the duties you owe to God and the duties you owe to a secular system as a licensed professional, the duties that you owe to God are going to be more important. And this is encapsulated in a Talmudic expression, Divrei HaRav v'Divrei HaTalmid, the words of the master, the words of the disciple. Divrei Mishomim, who do you listen to? Of course you listen to the master, thank you. You listen to the master, you listen to the teacher. Now we're going to see it's a lot more complicated because sometimes the halachic system itself compels you to obey a secular norm, and therefore obeying a secular norm is not violating the halacha. It is complying with it. But if there, so we call that in legal philosophy a false conflict. So it's not a true conflict because halacha itself might give deference. But when you have a true conflict, there is absolutely no question that halacha requires that you give obedience to God because He is the master of the universe. So as a result, although Baruch Hashem, conflicts in this area are not great, but when there are going to be conflicts where secular law says keep quiet and halacha says you got to speak up, you would generally have to follow the halacha, even if that could result potentially in even disciplinary action or the like, and we will talk about that. So first, we understand that it is an axiom of medicine, and not just medicine, but almost every professional practice, whether it's law, social work, psychology, even accounting, that there is a general prima facie duty called confidentiality, that information that was revealed to you in the course of your rendition of medical services must be kept confidential unless there is some compelling reason to reveal it, right? This is called confidentiality. It is even indeed built into the Hippocratic Oath itself that you will not reveal patients' confidences. Why is there a principle called confidentiality? Why does secular law and ethics consider confidentiality to be so sacrosanct? So, number one, part of it is a simple sense of decency and respect for the dignity of people. Right? People have dignity, they're made in the image of God, there's kind of a religious basis for this, and to simply bandy around private, intimate, personal details that could make them uncomfortable is a violation of dignity. From a more utilitarian justification is that people who know ahead of time that information about them might be spread to other people without their consent might be less willing to seek treatment, might be less willing to describe the situations which gave rise to their illness. For example, a person might not want to tell his doctor he got AIDS by having homosexual sex if that's going to be in the New York Times the next day. So as a result, what's going to happen is, again, this is speculative, but at least in some cases, people are not going to seek the medical treatment that they need, or by extension, they're not going to seek the legal representative, whatever it is, that they need, and as a result, people are going to be hurt. Confidentiality is a way of encouraging people in need to utilize the system for whatever it is they need, right? That's kind of the, we'll call that the utilitarian justification of confidentiality. Now, I first want to discuss a little bit of the secular aspects, and then we're going to move into the halacha and compare them. Even in the secular system, it is very, very well established that although confidentiality is the norm, it is not going to be 100% of the case. There are going to be times in which not only is it permitted to reveal a confidence, but indeed a person is obligated to reveal a confidence. Let me just mention two examples. One example are laws regarding mandatory reporting of spousal and child abuse. You have a patient, a woman, or a men could be abused as well, although it's less common. You'll see you have a woman or a child. There is some evidence of injuries which seem to indicate the possibility of abuse. Well, and the wife begs you, please, 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 please don't tell, you know, either I love my husband or I'm scared of my husband, it might be one or the other. But if indeed there is a law that says you must report, if you were to assert confidentiality, if it was discovered you didn't report, you would actually be liable. You could go to jail, you could certainly be fined, you would be subject to discipline. Now, mandatory reporting is not limited to physicians. It actually applies to nurses. It applies to teachers. And if teachers become aware of something looking at a child and the like. So mandatory reporting is the obvious example of where confidentiality is superseded by a paramount need to protect people who would otherwise suffer. A second example is the very, very famous, what is called the Tarasov Doctrine. Tarasov simply was the name of a psychiatrist. This goes back to a very, very famous legal case in California. I think it was the 1960s, a long, long time ago already, in which a patient undergoing psychiatric treatment actually told the psychiatrist that he was planning on murdering a girlfriend or a former girlfriend. And the psychiatrist did not call the police, did not warn the girl's family or warn the girl, because he basically said, what can I do? You know, this is confidential information. What happened, unfortunately, was that the young lady was murdered, and the family sued Dr. Tarasov for wrongful death, for indirectly causing the death of this woman. It was a civil proceeding, it was not a criminal proceeding. And the California Supreme Court basically created what is known to this very day. Perhaps you've even heard of this phrase, the Tarasov Doctrine, that basically says that a physician or a psychiatrist is duty-bound to reveal information in order to prevent, in order to protect, rather, innocent people from imminent danger. Now, that's not going to always be very, very clear. Sometimes patients describe delusions, fantasies, in a very large proportion. They probably are not going to act out those fantasies. The person might just say, hey, doctor, I've had this dream about, you know, taking a knife and ripping people apart. And it's going to be a very difficult case sometimes to balance. When am I simply dealing with somebody's, you know, mishugas, so to speak, and I have to help him as a patient, but he's not a serious threat of danger, versus when Tarasov applies. I can't give you a clear answer, but that does mean that you as medical professionals will have to make judgments whether somebody poses a genuine threat or danger to third parties, and if that is the case, confidentiality goes out the window and you are obligated to violate the confidence. And if you don't do so, not only do you face disciplinary proceedings, you can face fines, wrongful death actions, and imprisonment, as well as malpractice, you know, and everything else. So that's a very, very important second exception to confidentiality. So we have mandatory reporting laws, and we have Tarasov doctrine. Actually, the two are related, because in truth, the theory of a mandatory reporting law is also to prevent further injury. So it's almost the same type of doctrine. A little bit, for those of you who enjoy little twists and turns, it's very, very interesting that the California Supreme Courts only applied Tarasov to danger to third parties. It did not apply Tarasov to danger to the patient himself. It's very, very interesting where, let's say, a patient is telling his doctor that he has serious thoughts of suicide, and in fact he's even accumulated, he's stockpiled the pills and the like. The case in California was, doctor didn't tell the family or didn't alert the police or whoever might have stopped it. Patient committed suicide. Doctor was sued. The doctor was permitted to assert this was confidential information, because Tarasov only compels disclosure to protect third parties. It does not compel disclosure to protect the patient himself. Now, in truth, the doctor could have had the patient civilly committed if he was a threat to himself, but on the other hand, he was not obligated to do so. Again, this is an interesting subtlety between hurting other people and hurting yourself, in which Tarasov does not apply. Now, as a general rule, what does halacha say about all of this? So, one thing that's very interesting is, halacha does not have a special category called professional confidentiality. Meaning in the secular world, we have codes of ethics for doctors, and codes of ethics for lawyers, and codes of ethics for social workers, and codes of ethics for psychiatrists and psychologists. Halacha does not assign duties based on your professional role. There is only one body of halacha, and if it applies to professionals, it only applies to professionals the same way it applies to everybody else. So that's the first kind of unique aspect here, that there is no unique set of rules that applies to professionals. There are only the general rules of halacha. Now, what are the general rules that are going to be relevant here? So the general rules that are going to be relevant is a body of halacha that's very important, and that is called Lashon Hara. And in order to understand how this applies in the medical area, we need to talk about Lashon Hara in a very general sense. Lashon Hara quite literally means evil speech, derogatory speech, and it basically creates a law in the Torah that one is not allowed to say to another person any revelation which is potentially embarrassing or derogatory, or humiliating, or even something the person would just want to keep private. I am not allowed to say things about other people to you, to my children, to my wife, to my parents. Right? There is this law called Lashon Hara, and it's absolutely the case that even if it's true, because if what you're saying is false, that's a much bigger sin. That's called Motzi Shemra. And that's a bigger sin. Lashon Hara is not limited to false speech. It applies specifically to true speech. So what we start off with is the following, therefore. Obviously, there are going to be a lot of exceptions. Okay, but if we just look at the naked, bare rule, you are not allowed to reveal, it's not just a doctor, nobody is allowed to reveal negative, embarrassing information about a person without their consent, because that is the sin of lashon hara. Now, you might think, you might argue with me, and you might say, well, wait a second. If I describe lashon hara as something that is negative or derogatory, well, that would depend. If I say somebody got AIDS because he had homosexual sex, perhaps that's derogatory. But if I say somebody has cancer, that's not derogatory. In other words, you might make the argument that something is lashon hara only if it says something bad about a person, but not if it says something that's, you know, not derogatory. So here we have to add that lashon hara includes within its ambit not only things that are negative and derogatory, but also things that are either embarrassing or that a person would not want to be known to other people. So lashon hara encapsulates a respect for the privacy of a person as well as their reputation. Right, so we do start off with prima facie this rule of lashon hara, which tracks the general concept of confidentiality. So far, the only major difference is that secular law only imposes these duties on professionals. So for example, if I'm a janitor and I happen to eavesdrop and look at, I may be prosecuted for that, but if I happen to overhear somebody talking on the subway about cancer and I tell other people about it, I have not violated any secular law because a janitor is not bound by confidentiality. Now, if he actually looked at the medical records, that's a separate thing, but if he simply picked it up by overhearing it. In fact, even a doctor isn't bound. If you happen to have an MD, and this guy's not even your patient, and you happen to hear confidential information about his medical treatment, but not through your capacity as a physician, secular law does not bind you to any confidentiality. Halacha is very different. Halacha says, we don't care how you heard it. We don't care from whom you heard it. There is a duty not to speak lashon hara. So when we start off with this, it actually turns out that the duties of confidentiality are stronger in halacha than they would be under secular law, because they do not depend on your status as a professional, and they do not depend in what capacity you receive the information. Okay, now, let me digress for a moment. That is, because lashon hara is a body of Jewish law, but because even very orthodox and religious people, all of us, are prone to violating this and the like, so we are unique. We actually have a big, massive halachic work describing the laws of permitted gossip, prohibited gossip, what can you say, when can't you say it, etc. And this was authored by a great, great sage, great, great rabbi, one of the greatest rabbis, perhaps the greatest rabbi of the 20th century. He died in 1933. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen. He lived in a small village in Poland called Radin, and he is best known by his nickname, the Chafetz Chaim. Perhaps you've heard of the Chafetz Chaim. Why is he called the Chafetz Chaim? Because Chafetz Chaim means he who desires life. And this is taken from a verse in Psalms. Who is the person who desires life? Guard your tongue from evil. So when he wrote the book on the laws of lashon hara, he said, Chafetz Chaim. He called his book Chafetz Chaim. Who desires life? He who guards his tongue. And he became known by that book. He became known as the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was a great, great Talmudic scholar. In fact, it's fascinating that just this year, they unearthed. We have a picture of the Chafetz Chaim, but very few. Actually, not that many pictures. We have one or two pictures, but they actually found an old video fragment of the Chafetz Chaim coming to a rabbinic convention. And again, if you looked at it, you wouldn't necessarily be impressed if you didn't know what you were looking at. But for people who've been studying the Chafetz Chaim, learning about the Chafetz Chaim, this was just remarkable just to see him in the flesh, so to speak, see him walking. It's only around 30 seconds. So, and unfortunately, some guy blocked it because Chafetz Chaim didn't like to be photographed, so as they're showing the photos and walking, some big guy just stands in front and blocks it. So we only get around 25, 30 seconds of it. But it's very, very moving for people. Now, the Chafetz Chaim was not only a phenomenal scholar, the Chafetz Chaim became a folk hero. There are many legends about him because he was so saintly and pious. He was meticulous in everything, but in particularly the laws of speech, that he only said things that were positive. Although it's interesting, it is recorded that you might think a person who is so careful not to say things that are negative would be quiet and silent and morose and taciturn. But it's actually reported he was very talkative. He would always talk thoughts of Torah, inspirational ideas. He believed that you don't keep these laws by not using your power of speech, but you use speech in positive and affirmative ways and not negative and destructive ways. He was not a silent person. He was a talkative, communicative, interactive person. But he trained himself never to cross the line into negativity and disparagement. For most of us, that's quite a hard job. So there are so many, many legends. I'm just going to tell you two stories about the Chafetz Chaim. For many years, he wrote his books anonymously, and he would sell them. He would not say he was the author. In other words, that's why he became known as the Chafetz Chaim, because people, before they knew he was Yisrael Meir HaKohen, they just said, oh, the author of Chafetz Chaim. So the story goes that he was once sitting on a train with a bunch of his books, going to Warsaw to sell his books, and a man saw him and said, oh, these are the books of the great Rabbi Chafetz Chaim. What a phenomenal scholar he must be. So the Chafetz Chaim says, well, I know him. He's nobody great. He's an average person. So the person got so incensed that he slapped the Chafetz Chaim in the face. He says, how dare you insult somebody who is obviously one of the great scholars of the generation. Anyway, when they got to Warsaw, at this point, there was a group of rabbis that already knew who the Chafetz Chaim was. So there's a welcoming committee. So the man that slapped him is getting a little worried. Gee, did I hit somebody important? What? So he just nudges somebody and says, who is that person over there? Says, you don't know, that's the famous Chafetz Chaim. So now the man is like totally abashed. I mean, he slapped the Chafetz Chaim because the Chafetz Chaim insulted the Chafetz Chaim, right? So he goes over to the Chafetz Chaim and says, Rabbi, please forgive me. I slapped you because I respect you so much that I slapped you because I thought you were being insulted. The Chafetz Chaim said, no problem, you taught me a lesson. All of my life I was teaching the importance of not disparaging others, not saying lashon hara about other people. You taught me I should not say lashon hara about myself either. And when I said, I was like, nobody, you know, I deserve a slap. Now, in this type of story, there's actually a profound insight, if you think about it. Because part of why we disparage others often comes from our own inner insecurities. If we feel not so great about ourselves, so I want to put somebody else down as if to say, well, he's no better. If a person has a healthy self-esteem and a healthy awareness of the positive contributions they make, they feel less of a need to be negative on others simply because they don't have to, you know, feel good by making somebody else look bad. Okay, so the Chafetz Chaim's point is very profound. Another story, I can tell you stories like that. I don't want to get into other part. I'll tell you one other short story because one should know about these great, great figures. That he once had a student. This was during Tsarist Russia. Poland was under the Tsar rule at the time, who was arrested for smuggling or something, and that was potentially a very, very dangerous offense. He could be executed for that. And the Chafetz Chaim was summoned, or he agreed to come to be a character witness, to testify that this student was an ethical person of good moral character. Now, in those days, in order to be a witness, you had to swear on a Christian Bible. And the Chafetz Chaim would not swear on the Bible, and the lawyer spoke to the judge seeking an exemption. The Chafetz Chaim didn't know Russian anyway, it would have to be through an interpreter, but seeking an exemption. So this is what the lawyer said. Your Honor, this is a man who never lies. He's incorruptible. He doesn't care about money. He would not lie for anybody. And I'll tell you a story, that this man was once walking in the street and a pickpocket took his wallet and his money. And the Chafetz Chaim ran after him yelling, I forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you, because he didn't want the pickpocket to have the sin of theft, which God would punish him for. So the Chafetz Chaim said, I forgive you. And he said to the judge, such a man cares more for ethics than money. He is not corruptible. So the judge looks at the lawyer and says, do you expect me to believe that story? The lawyer says, you know, judge, I don't believe it either. But all I know is they don't tell the stories about you and me that way. Which means, an interesting point, stories might be false. They might be what in Yiddish would say, baba meises. But the fact that they say such a story, that indicates that this is the type of character he was. So, the Chafetz Chaim wrote a huge, huge book about the laws of Lashon Hara. Now let me point out, it's important to know this, when a rabbi writes a book like this, he is not simply giving you his opinion. My opinion is... that's not the way halachic books are written, as you probably know from all of this material. Everything goes back to the Torah, number one, the Talmudic discussions, the commentaries on the Talmud, the responsa literature, Maimonides' rulings. The Chafetz Chaim had to integrate a huge, complex body of information. And the Talmud doesn't really have a section that talks about Lashon Hara. In other words, you kind of have to go all over the place. There's a ruling here, and a ruling here, an analogy here, and a distinction here. And you have to master all of this literature to then focus laser-like on how it applies to Lashon Hara. It's not simply you open the Talmud and we have, you know, all the laws of Lashon Hara. It's not that way at all. You have debates and discussions on all sorts of even seemingly unrelated things. And the Chafetz Chaim sits down and synthesizes this. So please keep in mind that although I say that the Chafetz Chaim wrote the laws of Lashon Hara, in no sense at all do I mean he simply invented a bunch of rules. Rather, he synthesized them from all of the sources of Torah and Halacha, mainly Talmud and the like. Now, what is interesting is that the Chafetz Chaim devotes much space, in fact, maybe more than 50% of the book, not simply telling you what you're not allowed to say, but telling you what you must say, meaning to say the same way Lashon Hara starts off with the rule, thou shalt not talk, there are going to be times in which you are actually absolutely obligated. And the basis of this is conceptually, that's why I say there's a large overlap between secular and halacha here. It's conceptually the same theory, or the same basis, as mandatory reporting laws and the Tarasov doctrine. And that is, when you are in possession of information, and the non-disclosure of that information may hurt an innocent third party, halacha requires, not permits, requires that you reveal that derogatory information in order to protect third parties from harm. And this is based on the fact that there is a biblical commandment, we actually talked about this the other day, Leviticus 19, Vayikra Perek Yotes, Lo Samod Al Dam Reyacha, which literally means do not stand by idly over your friend's blood. If somebody is at risk, you have an obligation to extricate them from risk, and the obligation applies even if that means you have to reveal information that would otherwise fall under the category of Lashon Hara. And there's a halachic label for this. This is called Lashon Hara L'Toelet, the revealing of negative information, L'Toelet for the constructive purpose of protecting third parties. I will say this. I will say that certainly this would include Tarasov, right? If someone's going to commit violence, I have a duty. It would certainly include mandatory reporting to prevent child abuse. But it would go beyond it. Halacha has a broader view of the need to protect third parties than perhaps secular law. Secular law is limited, as it were, essentially to murder or extreme violence, abuse or murder. It doesn't even cover suicide prevention. Halacha would absolutely say you have a duty to violate a confidence to prevent a suicide, and halacha would encompass financial improprieties as well. So for example, if my patient tells me he's planning on breaking into a museum and stealing the Mona Lisa, under secular law, the physician might have to preserve the confidence. Under halacha, even the prevention of a financial crime would justify that protection. Okay, we'll talk about the conditions. So one thing is, therefore, halacha embraces a concept that is very analogous to Tarasov and mandatory reporting, but it is broader. So in a sense, you might say that halacha and secular law both value confidentiality as a high and important value. But halacha allows it to be outweighed by the need to protect third parties a bit more than secular law. Secular law allows protection of third parties to outweigh confidentiality only in extreme cases of murder and violence. Halacha would be much more liberal in saying that the needs of third parties have to be paramount based on the commandment Lo Samad Adam Recha. Now, the Chafetz Chaim, interestingly enough, does not discuss doctors, because maybe there weren't that many doctors in the small town of Radin. But let me give you the situations that he does discuss. He does discuss at great length something that comes up for rabbis all the time, and for non-rabbis as well, and that is matchmaking. Boy and girl, man and woman, are going out. But you know something about one of the parties that's a bit negative. You know, for example, that this man once slapped his girlfriend in the face. Not this girlfriend, but he slapped another girlfriend in the face. And perhaps if the young woman would know this now, she would not want to be engaged to that person. Or perhaps he or she has a history of psychiatric medication. They're bipolar, but let's say it's under control. Now, again, we're not dealing with physicians here. I'm simply dealing with, I happen to know. He's my friend or my acquaintance or a member of my family and the like. Now, normally, for me to simply say, oh, somebody's on psychiatric medication or somebody slapped his girlfriend, that would be lashon hara. I mean, I have no particular reason to embarrass a person or dredge up the past. But if he's about to enter into a relationship with somebody, and that somebody might be hurt by not knowing this information, according to halacha, there would be a duty to reveal that information in one way or the other. Now, obviously, the Chafetz Chaim says the first thing is to go up to the perpetrator and say, you should talk about this. But if they don't, you know, you got to go ahead. Now, this is enormously complicated because obviously, you know, you might lose your friendship, you know, because you'll cause a breakup and the like. You can always send it anonymously, but that's a little underhanded. But also, there is a serious question about, again, let me emphasize this. Be sure you understand this. The obligation of revealing the information is not for the purpose of dredging up the past. If all you're doing is dredging up the past, that is lashon hara. It's to protect an innocent person from suffering future consequences. It's very important that you get that distinction. If I can reveal negative information about a man or a woman who are going to get engaged, it is not to reveal the past. It is to protect future abuse or future psychiatric breakdowns in a relationship that a person wouldn't want to have in their relationship. So if that is the case, if it's a future-oriented inquiry rather than a past issue, and the past is relevant only insofar as it indicates a probability of a future reoccurrence, the question then becomes, and every rabbi will face this, and again, non-rabbis as well, is there such a thing as a statute of limitations? Let's assume, for example, that a person hit his girlfriend or his former spouse 30 years ago. There's been no reoccurrence. He was institutionally committed 25 years ago. He's been functioning fine. Is there a point at which we can say that the risk of future occurrence is so slight that disclosure is no longer necessary to protect the innocent person? And once disclosure is not necessary, it now becomes lashon hara to bring it up? Or do you take the attitude, you know, particularly in abuse, many psychologists, psychiatrists say, once an abuser, always an abuser. They say it's like alcoholism. There is no cure. I don't know. It's a difficult issue. On one hand, Judaism very much believes in tshuva, repentance. We don't believe that a person is permanently a victim of their past. On the other hand, am I allowed to be so righteous at the possible expense of somebody else? In other words, it's fine for me to say, you know, I mean, let's say, once the woman knows the guy was an abuser, but he says, I haven't done it for 30 years, Okay, so she can then make a decision. I accept your tshuva. I think your tshuva is sincere. You know, God forgives you. That's a decision a person can make. But if I'm the third party rabbi, am I permitted to gamble with somebody else's life? Can I say, there's repentance, so why should I bother to tell her that he's a wife abuser? You know, very, very, very tricky. And there's no room here to play it safe, because there is no play it safe. If you keep silent when you should have spoken, you are held morally accountable by God for whatever abuse or destruction happens in that relationship. If you speak up when you should have been silent, you are guilty of destroying a relationship that might have been successful. So you have to weigh this very, very carefully. You're between a rock and a hard place. And as I say, physicians will have similar issues. I mean, let's say you're a doctor and your patient is engaged and the like. Now, here I would say that secular law and halacha may part their ways because, once again, secular law compels disclosure, as I say, only in a comparatively rare number of scenarios. It compels disclosure in the case of murder. It may compel disclosure in the case of probable abuse. That's the Tarasov of mandatory reporting. AIDS has special rules. If your patient tells you he's going to have unprotected sex with a partner to whom he has not disclosed the HIV virus, so there is a protocol in place. Again, you have to follow the steps, in which if he does not reveal that information or stop having unprotected sex, you have a mechanism to reveal it. But even that's predicated on threat to life. But if I have a patient that's bipolar, and he's not a threat to life, but he has, you know, psychiatric breakdowns, or he's psychotic, or schizophrenic, but not necessarily suicidal or prone to violence, but he has episodes, or even something like epilepsy, and he informs me he's getting engaged. According to secular law, for me to reveal that information to the prospective family would be an absolute violation of confidentiality in the absence of imminent danger. And yet, paradoxically, halacha might require that I reveal that information, whether I'm a physician or not a physician, whether I got the information in the course of professional treatment or not. So, now that I think about it, maybe I should go back to what I said in the beginning of my remarks were, because I'm thinking about it more and more, I see there are problems. I said, it's not a real complicated, because secular and halacha move in the same direction. Actually, you can see that in many ways, they start off with very similar premises, but the applications do diverge very, very considerably. And generally, they move in the direction of halacha is much more pro-disclosure, and secular law is much more limited in the permissibility of disclosure. Yeah.
How would you defend yourself in a secular court when you go
up? Yeah, okay, I'm going to talk about that. That's a very, very important and practical question. Let me just mention, the Chavetz Chaim goes on with other things besides shidduchim are marriage arrangements. He talked about business partnerships. Let's say Beryl and Shmerl. Again, in Eastern Europe, we weren't talking about derivatives and fancy business transactions. We're talking about the tailor, you know, whatever it is, you know, more or less simple, but they apply to complex business world as well. Beryl and Shmerl want to make a partnership, right? And you happen to know that Beryl is very irresponsible. Beryl has gone bankrupt the last five businesses and the like, and there's a very good chance that he would mess up Shmerl's business. So once again, although it's derogatory to say that Beryl is financially irresponsible, whether he's dishonest or just irresponsible or incompetent, but you have a mitzvah to save people from getting into bad business deals, and you can give them the warning. I mean, this makes a lot of sense eminently, because Lashon Hara is not about indiscriminately just keeping your mouth shut. When there are important reasons to protect people, go ahead and, you know, you go ahead and do what you have to do. But if it's just gossip value, now for that you keep quiet. Now, the question that you raise is a very, very excellent question. And that is, okay, let's say I reveal a confidence that halacha says I needed to reveal because somebody would be hurt. But it doesn't fall within the narrow range of mandatory reporting or tarasov. So as a result, I have breached my professional duty as a physician, although I have complied with halacha. Well, I now go before the disciplinary board that wants to either revoke my license or suspend my license. And my only defense was, I followed the tenets of my religion. Is that going to get me off the hook? Well, again, think about, be a lawyer for a moment. The Constitution of the United States, you've got to refer to American law, basically does say in the First Amendment to the Constitution that every person has the free exercise of religion. The government cannot punish me for exercising my religion. So here is the interesting question. If a person claims that halacha requires me to reveal information, and let's assume we can prove that. By the way, he would have to bring in rabbis and everything else. But let's say he brings in the rabbis, and of course, you're going to have a big question if each side brings in rabbis, and one is a reform rabbi, and that's going to be a big question. But let's even make it the simplest case. All things equal. Let's assume all the rabbis are, that's pretty much a miracle anyway, but all the rabbis say, yes, Jewish law said you had to reveal it. So there's no uncertainty about Jewish law. Can I, as the doctor, now say, you can't punish me for following my religion, because that would be unconstitutional because of freedom of religion? Well, sounds good. Unfortunately, that doesn't work. And let me tell you this. This is a very, very important case that the Jewish community was not happy with. This was around 25 years ago. This was the Smith case. And this involved an interesting thing. There was a Native American group, you know, American Indians, in Oregon. And part of their religious ceremonies was they smoked peyote is like psychedelic mushrooms. And peyote is on the list of forbidden substances. It's a drug, it's a narcotic. You're not allowed to take it. Right? You're violating federal drug laws. So they were prosecuted for the use of what they call controlled substances. Their defense was, hey, you can't send me to jail for smoking peyote because this is part of my religious ritual. First Amendment. Now, the court could have said, well, drugs are different. You know, it could have made a drug exception, but it didn't do that. What the court did was it said the following. It said, as long as the law is not discriminatory against religion, it's a general law. If it would have said, for example, if there would be a law that says you can't smoke peyote in a religious ceremony, that would be unconstitutional because you're punishing something for keeping their religion. But this is a general law. Nobody can smoke peyote. The fact that it affects your religious observance, that is simply a neutral side effect. And as a result, a neutral general law that limits my religious observance is not a violation of the Constitution. Now, peyote mushrooms really didn't care about, but if you think about how far-reaching this is an amazingly far-reaching law. For example, states have alcohol laws. Like minors can't have alcohol below 21 or 18, whatever the age is. Now, let's say I give my 10-year-old wine Friday night for Kiddush, or for the four cups of Passover. Now, technically I could say, well, this is my religion. But under the Smith doctrine, since this is a general law against alcohol, theoretically, now I'm not going to say practically, but theoretically the police could arrest you for serving alcohol to a minor, even if it's just Kiddush. Autopsies, major, major problem. Jewish law, you probably had a share in this, and this is not my topic, but generally speaking, I'm not getting into details, Jewish law strongly discourages postmortems on these Jewish patients. Now, let's say you have the law, now some states have religious exemptions, so if that works, that works. But let's say you have a general law that says that all deaths from unexplained causes, or all deaths from crimes, autopsies are mandatory. And you come in and you say, yes, but you're the next of kin. But autopsies are against our religion. You're infringing on my freedom of religion. Under Smith, nope, you're not going to get it under Smith. As long as this is a neutral law and it does not discriminate against religion. Same thing with animal sacrifices. You know, there is a Caribbean sect that practices in Florida, other places, that actually sacrifices animals. Like, you know, like we used to do in the temple, but they still do it. They sacrifice animals. Now, Florida, like most cities, you know, most states and cities, have rules that you're not allowed to slaughter animals except at licensed slaughterhouses. But these were people who were slaughtering little goats in the backyard and whatever. And they were prosecuted for violating the ordinances against slaughter. Once again, they claimed this is our religion. The Supreme Court said, well, if a city would make a law, you can't slaughter sacrifices in the city, that would be unconstitutional because that would be singling out religion. But if it's a general law that says don't sacrifice any animals, then it's neutral, right? So Smith is a very, very scary law for people who value religious freedom, and I don't want to get into all the legalities, but it's something to be aware of. But coming back to your immediate question, therefore, it would seem to me that if I violated professional confidentiality because halacha requires me to do so, I will not be able to assert as a defense that I was following my religion, because under the doctrine of Smith, United States Supreme Court opinion, if the rules of confidentiality are general rules that apply to all doctors, and they don't only say Jewish doctors can't do that, it doesn't say it that way, so I would be in trouble. So the question then becomes, so now let's focus it the other way. If indeed halacha requires that I reveal information, and the revelation of that information is a violation of my secular duty, and I will not be able to assert the First Amendment of the Constitution as a defense under the Smith Doctrine, where does that leave us? This is a very long answer to your question. So, one possibility is you've got to take the consequences. You have to be a martyr for God. It's martyrdom. This is a tough decision. That means if I get my license suspended, you know, so be it. That's a very, very tough decision, but sometimes in life we make that decision. Now, possibility number two is maybe you try to keep the halacha, but keep yourself under the radar, such as anonymous letters, anonymous phone calls, meaning to say you reveal it, but you don't reveal that you're the one revealing it. Now, that may or may not work, because they may catch you, and then it'll even be worse. But one way out of this ethical dilemma is reveal the confidence in compliance with halacha, but disassociate yourself so that that way you have plausible deniability. And, okay, now again, ethically that's a little uncomfortable, because one would assume if I stand up for my principles, I should stand up for my principles. Both of these are hard, unpleasant choices. Now there is a third choice. There is a third choice, which is a... I'm sorry. Well, okay, and you're 100% correct. That the very, I don't know how you coerce it, but the very first step is you talk to the person and you really demand, whatever demand means, that they reveal it. You're 100% correct. If I wasn't explicit, I want to be explicit now. Before you violate confidence, you must try to get the person himself to reveal the information. That's 100% true. But let's assume that failed. Like, what's the next step? So there is a third step, which I call a loophole. But again, it may be a halachically permissible loophole. And that is that even when there's an obligation to protect people from harm, if the consequences to you are the loss of livelihood, possible forfeiture of license, and in some extreme cases, possible imprisonment, you are not obligated to assume those risks in your duty of rescuing third parties. Which means, in a sense, the halacha gives you an out akin to force majeure, meaning halacha is basically saying you're supposed to reveal the information, but if the consequences are going to be so drastic. And I think this is especially strong argument in medicine, Because after all, as a doctor, you yourself may be in a position to save lives in the future. So maybe your argument is, my long-term ability to serve patients and protect people is going to be destroyed by the short-term intervention to help this person because of the disciplinary proceeding and the like. So maybe there is a calculus now of not revealing. This would be the halakhic out, but I would say that that depends on a very difficult weighing, and that depends on how serious the consequences of third person. If it's something that's violence, you're going to be okay anyway because Tarasov is going to come in. And it also depends on the probability that you'll get in trouble. Meaning to say, if looking at the histories of the medical board and the like, they tend not to be so tough on this. You know, there's a difference between a license revocation and a one-week suspension. You know, you have to look at differences and make those judgments. But if push comes to shove, if the consequences are very, very, very severe, you do have a halachic out not to disclose that information. Okay, but as I say, in some cases, it may be the case that you have to be a martyr, and that goes back to the very first thing that I said, that we have multiple identities in life, and our professional identity is not our only identity, and it may not even be our most important identity. And as a result, if I have to sacrifice one identity in order to preserve the integrity of the other identity, that is a step I'm going to have to make. Let me just give you a very interesting situation that arose in New York, and it actually involved New York. Many states have this, but New York actually has a clergy penitent confidentiality requirement. It's very, very fascinating that if somebody tells a rabbi or a priest anything, of course, in the Catholic Church, that was a matter of canon law. The seal of confession is inviolate. But this was codified as a general rule that if I come to a rabbi, a priest, a minister, an imam, and I come to them in their spiritual capacity to give me spiritual advice, they cannot reveal any confidential information unless it falls within mandatory reporting or tarasuf. That is the secular law. So let me give you an actual case in New York. A man and a woman were going through very, very difficult marital separation. The woman went to the rabbi, and she confided to the rabbi that although she was still having relations with her husband, she was no longer going to the mikveh every month, the ritual bath. She said she was, but she wasn't doing it anymore. Now, this creates a real problem because a couple is not allowed, halachically, is not allowed to have marital intercourse until she goes to the mikveh. Then she was not going to the mikveh. So the rabbi told the husband, your wife is not going to the mikveh. Okay. Parties get divorced. They now have a custody battle over their child. And the husband asserts that wife should not have custody because she's not going to raise the child as an Orthodox kid. And even though the mother said, what do you mean? I keep Shabbat and Kashrut. He says, oh yeah? You don't keep family purity? Because Rabbi Flam told me that you don't go to the mikveh. So you are not fit. Now, you might argue that's not relevant to the kid, but okay. But he brought it out, and as a result, number one, she was humiliated. And number two, I believe that since the agreement was the child would be raised in an Orthodox environment, the woman's custody rights were compromised. She turned around and sued the rabbi that the rabbi breached his duty of confidentiality, resulting in her embarrassment and her loss of custody by revealing information that he was not allowed to reveal. The rabbi's defense was, my religion required me to reveal that information. Well, I'll tell you, we rabbis were really, really scared of that decision. Ultimately, the New York the Supreme Court of New York is called the Court of Appeals. That's the highest court in New York. Ruled she couldn't recover, but it was a technicality. In other words, the court basically said that even though the rabbi violated confidentiality, the private person does not get damages for that. In other words, what would have happened is some disciplinary proceeding or whatever it is. In other words, it wouldn't give a right for damages. Okay. So that saved us, but that still meant that there is no defense to a breach of confidentiality that you're keeping your religion, and that's based on the Smith, idea, and the like. So these are difficult issues. Let me just end with one final thing, and that is, I know that nobody here is planning to being a journalist, but let's just, once we talk about Lashon Hara, the question you might raise is, well, gee, can a religious Jew be a reporter? What is a reporter? I mean, you know, reporters aren't reporting on, you know, Miss Jones had a wonderful day today, you know, she took her dog for a walk, you know. That's not going to be in the news. You're reporting about bribery, about affairs, about dishonesty. Isn't all of this Lashon Hara? Let's say you're an investigative journalist. Your job is to expose corruption. You're saying all sorts of bad things about people. So here, let me point out that once again, the Chafetz Chaim's guidelines give us a way out of this. Because people need to know the behavior of their elected officials. They need to know if people are corrupt, if people are dishonest, if people are cheating, because that enables them to make decisions as to who will govern them in terms of elections and the like. So generally speaking, true investigative journalism that uncovers governmental corruption or that evaluates, and it's true for scientific journals. What are we going to say? If I discredit your research study, am I guilty of Lashon Hara? I mean, certainly. Am I saying something bad about you? Yeah, I am. But that's necessary for science, right? So certainly when you have a constructive benefit that will prevent harm to future people, that's perfectly justified. But what's interesting is that that may mean that a whole species of journalism is improper, and that is gossip journalism. It's one thing for me to publish a study that scientific data was falsified, or to publish a study that the city council, that members of the city council took bribes. That is legitimate because that helps the public or the scientific community, depending, in making decisions. But if I publish articles about some football player having affairs, or some actor, the way he treats his wife and kids, there is no particular need for me to know that information, and it doesn't impact on the decisions that a society makes. So, you can be a reporter for the New York Times or the Atlantic Monthly, but maybe People Magazine might be a little bit more difficult, halachically. Because when you have journalism that is devoted to gossip that does not pertain to public affairs and does not pertain to scientific research or anything that is needed to restructure society, it then becomes Lashon Hara. So the interesting question I'll leave you with is, so how does that apply to the personal life of public officials? Let's say you have the President of the United States. You may remember, maybe you were young, maybe you weren't born, remember Bill Clinton, right? So Bill Clinton, you recall, had various marital infidelities while he was in the White House. Now, if Bill Clinton was engaged in some corrupt activity vis-a-vis China, absolutely there's an obligation to investigate that and report that, because people have to know how our public officials are managing their public responsibilities. That determines elections, that determines impeachment, that determines all sorts of things. But is it relevant for us to know that Bill Clinton as a person was not living up to his marital responsibilities, if that does not impact on his political office? Now, by the way, you may wonder, so why am I even mentioning it? Once it's public knowledge, it's not much known anymore. But let's say initially, if I was the reporter, so I can talk about it now, but if I was the reporter and I'm a religious Jew, am I allowed to break the story? So again, there's not a clear answer, and I can give you another share of this. I'll just end with this idea. This really depends on whether you take the position that general moral character is relevant to how a person carries out his public life. Meaning, do you believe in schizophrenia, so to speak? Meaning to say, I'm a wonderful public servant and I happen to be an abominable person in my personal life. Or do you, and indeed I think we've seen that a lot, there are some very, very capable public servants who are just not nice people. Or do you say, inevitably there's going to be a spillover? If somebody is dishonest in his marital vows, if somebody doesn't live up to their personal commitments, that is not just a personal thing, that reflects on their fitness to hold office. That's going to be a question, and that's going to tie in directly to whether it's Lashon Hara or whether it's something that the public should know. Okay, so these are some questions to think about in terms of confidentiality. So I guess the bottom line message is that halacha is much more proactive in caring about innocent parties at the expense of confidentiality than the secular system. But halacha will give you an out in not revealing if you would suffer some very severe licensure sanctions. Okay, have a good day. We'll see you later.